I'm not sure if Jeff is actually going to be part of the presentation, but Jeff is one of the co-authors, and he's here with us. We have a 30-minute session now for the DNS, for the KSK Sentinel presentation.
I'm fine. I'm lazy. I'll sit.
Okay. Warren, you're up.
I'm just trying to figure out where I can sit and still reach a mic. There we go. Thank you. Yep. So, hello, everyone. Looking around the room, I'm guessing a number of people have already seen this presentation.
Only 12 times,
is there anyone who hasn't seen the presentation? Okay. Okay. Well, I guess this will be much more interactive then. So, basically, this is a joint work with myself and Jeff Houston, who's over there, and Joao, who I don't think is in the room. oh, dear, Jeff's coming over to help. So, what is the problem that we're hoping to address with this? Well, as a few people have mentioned recently, we want to roll the DNSSEC Trust Anchor, the DNSSEC KSK sometime. And users who do not yet have the KSK or users who are using validating resolvers, which do not have the new KSK yet, will break. Basically, all of their DNS will stop. This basically means for them their internet will stop, because without the DNS, nothing really works. And more worryingly, we don't have any way of measuring the actual deployment of the new key. This means that we don't know how many people or who will break when this happens. So we heard recently that there's this thing, RFC 8145. This was published in, I think, published in mid-2017. And what this is supposed to do is it signals which trust anchors specific resolvers have. So this sounds fairly much exactly like what we want, right? We'd like to know what resolvers have what keys. This will tell us how the key role is going to go. This will let us know if it's safe or not. Unfortunately, no. What this does, as I said, is it provides reporting from DNSSEC validating resolvers. It lets DNSSEC validating resolvers tell you what particular key it has. In my basement, I have a DNSSEC validating resolver. It runs in a Docker container, which means that I restart it. Actually, let me unplug. For some reason, I'm getting the translator is translating me to something else. There we go. That helps. So yeah, I have a validating resolver in my basement. I restart it every day for various long and complex reasons. This means that the validating resolver in my basement never gets a chance to learn the new key. In order to learn the new key and start trusting it, you need to see it, and then you need to have it live for 30 days. My resolver never has that because I restart it and it starts up clean. However, I don't think this is actually important. Nobody's actually sending it any queries. So, you know, it's a resolver that falls in the forest. It doesn't make any noise because nobody's actually using it, but it's reporting statistics. This means that it shows up in the graph of resolvers and resolvers that are doing RFC 8145 reporting. For those who haven't seen this graph before, this is a graph that was published by VeriSign in, I think, sort of October-ish 2017. And it shows the progression of the new trust anchor being deployed. In mid-July, the new KSK was published. In mid-August, the hold-down timer expires, which means that everybody should start learning the new key and should start putting it in their trust anchors and should start reporting that. For some reason, only most of them did. But around 5 to 7% of resolvers, for some reason, did not pick up the new key. And if people were watching the presentations earlier today, They saw that number has sort of jumped to 30%, and we're not entirely sure why. But whatever the case, RFC 8145 only provides reporting from resolvers. This does not provide reporting from users. And what we think is much more important is for an ability to understand what the user impact of the KSK rule will be. Now, it's all fine and good to know the set of resolvers is going to be okay or not, but we don't really care about that. What we care about is when the key rolls, will users still be able to use the internet? So we have a new process. It's called KSK Sentinel. It requires a very simple set of updates to resolver software. And it allows anybody who can publish a name in the DNS to set up a measurement service. But more importantly than all of that, it exposes the result of the tests to the users. The current measurement system provides reporting from the resolver to the root server operators and the IANA, or sort of the IANA through the root server operators. What this does is it lets individual users have a look at their resolver and understand if they will be okay or not. It also allows for large-scale internet measurement. I'm guessing most people here have seen some of the presentations which Jeff has done, where he serves, you know, Google ads or similar to a huge set of the population and then gets millions of people to run a test. The plan is that Jeff will do a test using this infrastructure, the KSK Sentinel, to actually sort of sample millions of users and get much better reporting on how they will work. So how does this KSK Sentinel thing actually work? So the changes are two very simple rules. A validating resolver that has been upgraded to support this will do all of its normal DNS validation process, all of its normal DNS resolution. When it gets a question, it goes off, it does its standard set of work. But as the very last thing that it does before sending back the response, it has a look, and it sees if the leftmost label in the queue name, in the sort of question that was asked, does it start with this magic string? And the magic string is KSKRoll-Sentinel-IsTA, and then a key number. If it sees the string, and if it has that particular key, the one that has that key ID, then it replies normally. If it does not have that key ID, then it takes the valid correct answer and it returns a serve fail. Basically what it does is it pretends that while it was doing the validation, it had some sort of issue validating the answer, or while it was trying to do the resolution, it ran into some sort of answer. Serve fail is now the generic, you know, something went wrong error. The second rule is basically the inverse of the first. It's KSK role sentinel not TA. And what this question is asking is, if you do not have the key, then you should reply normally. If you do have the key, then you should turn that into a serve fail. And so when you first look at this, it seems a little weird that we're asking two questions, one being the inverse of the other. I mean, these can't both be true at the same time. And yep, that's right. That's exactly the point. These can't both be true at the same time. So to see why, here's a little example. I am a DNSSEC validating resolver. I support Sentinel. When I realize I don't really look like a DNSSEC validating resolver, they're normally sort of black and square, and I'm not. But I am a DNSSEC validating resolver, and I have the new KSK. The key ID for the new KSK, which has just been released, is 20326. I am walking along, and I get a query for invalid.example.com. This particular name, as sort of it implies, is an invalidly signed record. I do my normal DNSSEC processing. Because it's invalidly signed, I send back serve fail. Nothing has changed yet. I then get a query for KSK role sentinel ista 20326.example.com. I do all of my normal work. I do the normal resolution step, I do the normal validation step, and I get back an IP address of 192.0.2.23. Now, this is just an example. I get back whatever the zone publisher has put in the zone. Because I support Sentinel, and because I'm using key ID 20326, I just answer normally. You know, the question asks, is this a trust anchor that you have? I do, in fact, have that trust anchor. And so I just forward off the answer that I got. A few seconds later, I get a query for KSK role Sentinel, not TA 20326. I do all of my normal validation process. I get back whatever IP address I get back from the authoritative server. However, I do have, and I'm using ID 20326. So basically, I do not have this trust anchor. So I send back the serve fail. Basically, the Simpsons, I'm not licking toads, right? I do not have that TA. Sure. Oh, yep. For the remote people, it is slide 7. So all we've done so far is we've added a whole bunch of complexity to the DNS. And adding complexity to the DNS is all fun and good. Is it actually useful? And if so, how? So I think that most people can see the slides up on the screen. Basically, invalid.example.com/fish. KSK role sentinel is ta20326.example.com/kitten. And KSK role sentinel, not ta20326.com, example.com/puppy. And the plan is we ask users to please go to a web page that has all of this on it. And then we ask users, when you wrote this web page, do you see a picture of a fish? If you see a picture of a fish, you'll also see likely a kitten and a puppy. But if you see a picture of a fish, then that means you were able to successfully resolve the invalid.example.com domain name. If you were able to successfully resolve invalid.example.com, that means that you're not using a validating resolver. If you're not using a validating resolver, you really don't care about the KSK role. In fact, you don't care about the key at all. It in no way affects you. If you're able to only see a picture of a kitten and a puppy, then that means you could not get the invalidly signed record, so you're using a validating resolver. But it means you were able to get both the is TA 20326 and the not TA 20326 message, names. Seeing as you can't both simultaneously have and not have the trust anchor with that key ID, that means that the resolver you're using has not yet been upgraded to support Sentinel. This means that we can't tell you if you will survive the key role or not. If you only see a picture of a kitten, then that means that you were able to load is TA 20326, and you were not able to load not TA 20326. That means that you will be perfectly fine during the key role. You have the new key. It's in your root trust anchor store. You will be just fine. If you only see a picture of a puppy, then that means that you only have the old key, right? You do not have 20326. This means that when the KSK role finishes and the existing key that you're relying on gets removed, your DNS will break. So are we really planning on using pictures of kittens and puppies and fish? I wish we were. It would be really awesome. Unfortunately, no. It doesn't really scale to ask every user on the internet to please go off and tell us which one of the pictures of kittens and puppies and fish that they see. Instead, we will serve them a big blob of JavaScript. And this big blob of JavaScript, what it does is it tries to load the kitten and the puppy and the fish equivalent. And then the JavaScript looks to have a look to see which of these it was actually able to resolve. And from that, it tells, it runs the test and tells you how you will be. Yep, I know it would be awesome if it was kittens. Unfortunately, still no. We have a demo of this at www.kskTest.net. And because I have a little bit of time and they crazily let me use their computer, let's make sure that it does actually work. So www.kskTest.net. And it is now going off. It's trying to load all of those records. It already did it. It has determined that the resolver that this computer is using is a validating DNSSEC resolver, and it is a legacy DNSSEC validating resolver. It does not yet support the Sentinel method. That means that, you know, this particular machine, and I guess everybody else here at the ICANN meeting, we can't tell them if they will survive the key role or not. So, you know, here's just my a screenshot of that, because I wasn't sure if I would have working internet here. Slide 9. So that's sort of the 50,000-foot view. I realize I tempted you with kittens, but you did not get any kittens. So here is the obligatory and somewhat gratuitous kitten picture. So questions, and questions other than, you know, why are the kittens doing gardening? Because I don't know. Federico. Is that Federico? Yeah.
Hi, Warren. Are you collecting the results of your test page?
Kind of, maybe. So on my particular page, this is just running, you know, I have an Apache web server that serves these resources. So I'm logging the fact that people are asking for the three records. But what's not actually shown is each one of the records has a random number appended to it, and they're different random numbers. And so, yes, they're being logged. I'm not looking at the logs. I don't have enough information from the logs to know. I guess I do have enough information from the logs to be able to tell what the percentages are. But no, I haven't bothered looking, and to be honest, I have no real intention to look, because so far most of the resolvers have not been upgraded. This was purely a proof of concept, and if you look at the code, oh, you'll definitely know it was just a proof of concept toy implementation. So yeah, I mean, I guess I do actually have enough info to look. I have no plans to, because I haven't thought about the privacy implications of that. Good question, though.
Warren? Hi, this is Viktor Duchovny. Are you aware of any work to get us beyond RFC 5011? We can measure all the ways in which it's not working, but maybe for the next KSK rollover 5-6 years from now, we can do better. Have you any thoughts about that?
Yes and no. And I think that Federico has a follow-up question, so I'll let him go after this. Wes Hardeker and I have been writing a document pointing out that the 5011 document is vague in some ways. One of the ways that it's vague makes it fairly dangerous and easy to shoot yourself in the foot. But there are a lot of other things in it which could probably be improved. Much of the problem so far, I think, has been things which aren't necessarily 5011's direct fault. That's either that people had implemented 5011 incorrectly because they couldn't quite follow the writing style, or much more likely, and these are just, you know, my views, or much more likely people configured the DNSSEC trust anchor, you know, as we told them initially, which is you should open your bind or named.conf file and say trusted keys equals and put in the key. For those who don't run bind, the trusted keys stanza says, this is the trust anchor. This will always be the trust anchor. Don't bother trying to roll the trust anchor because, you know, I will tell you when you need to replace it. We were telling people that because that was the best practice at the time. Actually, that was the only practice at the time. After we started telling people that, 5011 support was introduced into resolvers, but that required a different knob to enable it. And we think people didn't enable it. You know, they didn't bother changing trusted keys to managed keys. The third problem with 5011, or key rollover in general, is it seems fairly common for people to be using things like VMs or Docker instances now to run their name server. 5011 says when you see a new key that's signed with the old key, don't trust it for at least 30 days. This means that if you have a non-writable file system like you do in Docker, or if you've made your server secure by removing binds ability or whatever name server's ability to write stuff, you won't ever learn the new key. So most of those problems aren't actually issues themselves with RFC 5011. They're with users configuring things incorrectly because they followed what we told them to and then didn't hear the new info, or because the system can't write the new key anyway, anywhere anyway. This means that if we replaced 5011, you would still have that set of problems. But yeah, I mean, I agree, 5011 has lots of warts. Many people, or at least one person, would say, because we expected there to be an operational document and there should always be two KSKs in place at all times, and then it works better. But yeah, I agree, 5011 should be replaced. There has been a little bit of discussion on replacing it. Much of that involves doing things like pulling the new trust anchor from www.iana.org and trusting it because it's signed with a CA cert. So, yeah, there has been some discussion, but I don't think that there are better ideas.
Just a follow-up comment. I'd like to see the ability to roll forward from any past trust anchor that you're configured with whatever security risk you might therefore have, forward from there through a chain of signatures in DNS immediately without 30-day holdouts.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could actually kind of currently do that, except you'd start with the old key, wait 30 days, then move to the new key, wait 30 days. That would be fairly horrendous.
So let's get rid of those 30 days, make it zero.
It would also make testing way easier. So actually, I run another site, which is keyroll.systems? I can't remember. I wonder if it still works. Let's find out. And look, it's a new GTLD. They are actually in use. Wrong place. Keyroll.systems. Hey, it still works. So yeah, this is a quick demo site that I set up a long, long, long time ago. And it basically allows people who run 5011 to do testing. You know, it's a key that rolls every 90 minutes. The problem is, when I first set this up, the majority of resolvers weren't actually waiting 30 days to install a new trust anchor. And so you could just point your machine here and it would just work. People had basically ignored the and wait 30 days hold time. Then resolvers had it pointed out to them they weren't following the RFC, and so they started following it and waiting 30 days. So getting them to not wait 30 days would kind of be a regression. But anyway, it's good to know this still works. Who else had questions?
Yeah,
Frederico.
A very fast follow-up, actually, for all the authors, actually. And when what do you expect if everything goes smoothly now in the following weeks on the ITF? This is mostly for Jeff, I think. What would you... wait until we start to do your tests? Like, you will wait for a month and hope that everybody deploy those new resolvers, or what do you expect?
Necessarily, this is a change to the behavior of resolvers that are operating in a mode that validates the answers that they send back using DNSSEC. Because every answer now needs to look at the leftmost label, figure out if that's a, you know, key piece of text, and if it is, invoke this behaviour. At the moment, to my direct knowledge, a module in the NOT resolver from CZNIC has implemented this, but bind, unbound, and all the other stuff that folk use have not implemented it. So I suppose if I really wanted to find the market share of CZ.NICs, not resolver, I could unleash a test right now and it would show me that. But that, while useful to CZNIC, wouldn't be useful to anyone else. I was waiting for the 3 to actually have it integrated into releases that are out there, and then it would be good if folk filed a Red Hat bug and got Red Hat to integrate, you know, the later resolver into their releases. And it would be good if all this happened before August to give us some data. But, you know, like anything in the DNS, there's a lot of variables going on there, and only NOT has this implemented at this point. So I can't really push out a measurement ad at this point in time. There's just no results worth looking at.
And I guess, Warren Kumari, a quick follow-up to what Jeff said. People who are watching Sarah's presentation from just before the break saw, you know, there was a flat line of resolvers reporting RFC 8145 stuff. And then there's a huge spike where they all jump up to 30%. That big spike where they jump up is basically, or seems to be, people upgrading their versions of a resolver to deal with a security bug. So this means that what we need to do is wait for this to be deployed in resolvers and make sure that shortly after that, somebody exposes a vulnerability so everybody will go through an update. So, you know, start looking now.
Like not supporting Sentinel is a vulnerability. Yeah.
Jaap Akker from NLNet Labs. We've been waiting until the dust a little bit settles on the Sentinel, and we're in the middle of a release for Unbound on this moment. But as soon as that's over, we will have to put it in. So I mean, it's not a big deal. That's basically what it is.
Yeah, I think that we believe at this point that core system and the label is finally stable. So for folk who haven't been following the DNSSOC list, the actual string that you choose, the KSK role-sentinel-is-TA or not TA, that particular string has changed like 4 or 5 times. Five times, I guess. And, you know, that was sort of bike shedding. Not really an important change, but something that had been changing. We think it's now stable, so implementers should be able to rely on that particular implementation or string.
Any more questions? Yeah. Go ahead, Jeff.
Jeff Houston, I want to just make one more comment about this, and it kind of illustrates why are we having a second bite of this and what was actually wrong with 8145 in the first place. When you look at the DNS, you can look at it from two perspectives. One is actually trying to understand the behaviour of individual elements in the DNS resolution system. In other words, individual resolvers, and try and understand how individual resolvers are behaving. But users don't do that. They have a set of resolvers listed in etcresolve.conf, and if they don't like the first answer, they go to the second, go to the third. And there is a real question about what happens to users as distinct from what a resolver is doing. As an example, if you have two resolvers locally configured, one validates and one does not, the key role is irrelevant. Because from the validating resolver, even if they're not following a key role, all they're going to return back is serve fail. Serve fail says try the other. So the user is fine, even though some resolvers are not. This Sentinel will not uncover recalcitrant resolvers. It's not intended to. It cannot do that. What it can say is prior to a key role, what do we think is the population of users that might be left stranded with no working resolver? So it's kind of the damage scenario, and that's all it can measure. And so Victor's question about, well, what about resolvers? How can we fix this? If you want that kind of insight into the DNS, you've got to think a lot harder and make even more changes to either the protocol or resolvers, because we don't have that ability today. Thanks.
Go ahead, Chuck. One more question.
So the question I have is, so we have a label that's reserved for this test specifically. So the question...
This is Jeff. The label excites a behavior. The domain in which that label is located is up to you and me and anyone else who wants to run this test. The label triggers a behavior. That's all.
Leftmost label.
So the question I had is, are there any other labels that exercise different behavior? Is there like an INO registry somewhere of behavior labels? Because we're starting something here, right?
There is XN hyphen hyphen. Yeah. And some people would say all of the underscore labels. I mean, stuff like, you know, underscore XMPP, blah, blah, blah. They don't really excise different behavior in the DNS, but they excise some sort of different behavior. And also certain resolvers like bind, and actually some stub resolvers won't allow you to use underscore labels for things. Like if you use underscore foo with an A record, Android simply won't load it. I understand where you're coming from. We've randomly chosen a string and started using it. This should probably be documented in some sort of thing somewhere. The obvious place would be let's put it in the special use names registry, but I think everybody's like, we don't want to touch that. Let's choose a different registry, pane, etc.
Just one more comment. I forgot to say at the beginning, the session is translated in French and in Spanish, and it's available through the headset.
Well, let's thank Warren and Jeff for this information and the work. We have another question, quick.
Well, just a comment on X and dash dash. It doesn't affect DNS. It affects the next layer. So that's different.
Okay. Thank you very much, Warren and Jeff. Appreciate it. So the next person up is Andre and the clicker. Here, we can bring you the clicker, or you can do it there if you like.
Would you rather use clicker?
Yeah. Andre Philippe from CZ NIC will be our next presenter, and we're going to hear about some of their experiences from their tourist project. Thank you, Andre. You're up.
Good morning. Happy P Day. My name is Andre Philippe. I'm working for CZ NIC. And I would like to talk about one aspect of the project, which is called Tourist Project. Because it's not just a normal CPE device, it has many other features. Give me some time to introduce it a little bit. So what is Tourist Project? It started quite a while ago in 2013, and the main focus that time was to create, it has a very fancy name, Project of Shared Cyber Defense. And basically the idea was to create some CPE devices that will be spread out in the network, mainly at the edges of the network. They will collect some information to the center. We will somehow evaluate those information. We are also running a national SAR team. And then provide some firewall rules and security recommendations and stuff like that. So that was the basic idea. And then we continue work on this idea. We decided that the best device like that would be like home Soho router. We started to work on that. And also we added one more goal, because the situation in this field is really bad. Many of those routers have very strange firmware, they usually do not have updates of the firmware. So if there is some security bug, there is usually a little possibility how to fix this. Also, the support of technologies like IPv6 and also DNSSEC validation was very bad. So we continued on that. We hope to find some device on the market that we would just provide some addition to the firmware. Unfortunately, we couldn't find anything. So the result was that we created our own hardware. So we created our own small router. For the purpose of the project, we created just first generation of the router, which is called Tourist 1.0, and we did exactly 1,000 of those devices. Now you can see it on the screen. That's the blue router on the top left. Later on, because the results were very interesting, we wanted to extend a little bit the project, so we created a new version called Tourist 1.1, and again, we did like 1,000 of them, and the main focus that time was Czech Republic. So we were giving those routers to people in the Czech Republic for free. A few of them were also given to people abroad, but the super majority of the routers were in Czech Republic. And, then we started to publish the results of the project, and some people started to ask us, can we buy it, can we get one, and so on. Some were really trying to bribe me with credit card and everything. So, uh, uh, some are successful. And so we decided to make this a little bit broader project, and then we went for crowdfunding campaign because we wasn't sure if this device would be really, this could be sold on the market. It was a very successful campaign. We collected a lot of money and created this new router called Turis Omnia. So that's the current router which we are kind of selling, but, you know, please keep in mind we are not for-profit organization, so many of our activities are not really focused on profit. But this is all addition how we wanted to make the situation in the Soho field better. What is different with Turis Omnia is that it's open source, as everything we do, so it's not just open source software, but also open source hardware. And the good point is that the hardware is very powerful. We have much more memory than the same machines in this category, and that's why we can do much more thinking on this hardware. The operating system is called Turis OS, but basically is a little bit tuned OpenWRT. The main feature, and which is a key thing for it, it has automated updates. So whenever there is a problem, if there is some security bug, if you need to provide some, for example, new root key, we just issue an update, and we do it quite often, actually. We don't just do security fixes, of course. We add new features. So this, as I said, the hardware is quite powerful, so this device can be used for many, many other things, not just a router. As it started as a security project, security is the key point there, and we the main emphasis. So it has, this device shouldn't allow you to make some unsecure setup. It has a guide that guides you through the configuration process, doesn't allow you to have weak passwords or have some open ports and stuff like that. Also, the communication with the center, how the way how it gets the updates is very well designed. It has its own crypto chip with its own set of keys, so everything is in hardware crypto. And it has many other features which are not related to this talk, but it can run, for example, as honeypot. And again, that's the way we collect information. It does flow analysis, so it can, for example, find if in your LAN there is some vulnerable device which is scanning internet or doing something unexpected. As I said, we provide back the results of the collective analysis, so it has an adaptive firewall which changes according to the security situation. It can be run as a VPN server and many, many other features. Important stuff, it's fully IPv6 ready, and it's really very flexible. So you can even run Alexa containers, so you can run another server and as a virtual machine inside this router, which shows how powerful it is. And the most important for us, this is fully doing DNSSEC validation by default. So that's one of the source of joy and pain in this project, because as I will explain later, this is not really easy. One more remark, DNS is using quite a lot in this device. For example, we signal through the DNS which set of keys the device should use, because if there would be some security incident and some of the key set would be compromised, we can switch to another set of keys. So DNS is important, so that's why even validation is important in this device. So when we started that, and there was a lot of lessons learned. As I said, the operating system is developed constantly. So the situation at the beginning was very different. We were quite naive. We just thought that rolling the device that will do DNS validation is easy thing. But then we find out that it's not so easy. First of all, there is a lot of problems, if I should point to some group of organizations that causes that, they are mainly ISPs. They are very creative how they work with DNS and DNSSEC. So we very quickly learned that we need to provide additional GUI, some page that informs the user what's happening and why the router is not working properly. So that was one of the first updates in the operating system. The main problems are that ISPs usually have some broken DNS recursors. They just, set it up 10 years ago, and they believe that this is enough forever. Those, very old implementation of DNS causes problems. So whenever, for example, you use it as an upstream recursor, that's a bad thing. Even worse, sometimes they are very creative and install some middle boxes that do something magic with DNS traffic, mostly some bad magic. They had some reasons probably for this in the history. They probably wanted to fix some problem, so they installed this box, fixed that particular problem, and forgot it, unfortunately. And some of them, they just redirect the whole port 53 traffic to some recursor. So it's quite complicated to operate on this network if that resolver is broken, and that's unfortunately is often the case. One thing which was not just on ISP side, it was a little bit old problem. We started with not resolver. Actually, those blue boxes, the first one, they use unbound, but the Omnias, they use not resolver. And such implementation in a wild was also very, very interesting experience. So even we had some bugs in the resolver. But again, due to the fact that we can, instantly update the system, we were able to find a lot of bugs and fix them immediately. So now I think mainly because of this project, the resolver is very well-tested software. And last but not least, there are sometimes problems with some broken authoritative resolvers. Servers, mainly the EDNS issue. I think I will comment a little bit later. So this is the page that we developed just for the DNS. As you can see, it's a very long description of what's happening. Of course, not many people use it. They rather call us anyway. But at least we try to educate them that everything can be wrong and with DNS. And they have several options. They can either use or don't use the upstream resolver. And also, unfortunately, we had to allow them to disable DNSSEC validation at all. If you click to not to validate, you will get several warnings that you shouldn't do it, and you should do it just temporarily. But unfortunately, sometimes this is the last option, which says connectivity. So the people rather switch it off than not to be able to connect to the internet. But we did several tests that shows what's wrong, and some people are brave enough and are able to report this to the ISP. So at least we fix some of the issues at some ISP's network. But some ISPs are very resistant, and they have a huge belief that their perfect security DNS hack is the best solution in the world and should stay there forever. So unfortunately, sometimes it's a little bit faithless. But those two tick buttons solve a lot of issues and help a lot. So let me conclude. So mostly the problems are at ISPs. Again, they usually had some issues, some either problem with DNS or some security issues. Some introduce some solution and they forget that there is such solution. You need to discuss with them, and that's not for end user to be able to do this. So usually we try to help them, but of course doesn't work very often. We had to introduce your configuration interface with test. That helps a lot because at least power users understand the problem. And if you send such a screenshot to your ISP, if they have an operator with brain, they usually are able to understand what's happening. So that was a key point that decreased the number of calls to our support. And the last thing, which was announced at DNS Sorag last week, as you know, the developers of the open source resolvers decided to sunset the workarounds in Resolver during 2019. So at least this is something we will start to ignore starting February 1st, 2019, and we will be not the only one. So please, if you believe that you have some issues, please try that web page, try to test your domain and test if this domain name will be resolvable after February 2019. And if you allow me one more thing, we are just before launching a new version, by the way, so this is going to be a new tourist. It will be very, as you can see, it will be very, very flexible. With many parts, you will be able to play with that modular. And as again, we are not for profit organization, not really a hardware manufacturer. So we will again go for Indiegogo campaign. So if you like tourist project, just do not forget to check Indiegogo after during April, and you will see this beautiful toy. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andre. Jacques, go ahead. First question.
So by flexible, you mean we can grab it and just go like this?
Twist it. Let's say modular is probably the better word. You could be able to design your old dream routers.
Thanks.
Are you maintaining any... This is Viktor Duchovny. Are you maintaining any statistics on, you know, improvements in the ISP landscape, any sort of graphs that you can publish over time?
Yes. Well, and of course, since we are a company based in Czech Republic, our power is much, much bigger in Czech Republic. So locally, we were able to fix most of it. But, you know, phone call from Czech Republic to Belgium ISP doesn't help much. You know, they just ignore it just because one, for them, exotic device, then they do not fix the problem. We estimate, and it's really tough to say, that roughly... maybe a little bit less than percent of the users have such problems, so they need to do something with DNS. So that shows that majority of ISPs are okay, or at least the big ISPs are okay, but roughly 1% of the users have some issue with that.
Go ahead, Frederico.
Andre, the old hardware versions are compatible with the new software?
Yes. They have the same operating system. Although they have different CPU platform, we still keep and maintain the system. So many of them are older than, I think, 4 years, and they still have the absolutely new versions of everything.
Russ, just a follow-up question. Do you guys support any other platform because it's based on OpenWRT? Any other hardware that runs OpenWRT can run the Omnia software? Or?
Not really. There is not much CPU devices with 2 gigabytes of memory on the market, to be honest. And you know, for many things we do there, including the configuration system, automated updates, honeypots, and everything, we need a little bit more memory that is normally available. But that's one thing we could probably discuss. You know.
There's a mic back there, or up here. Yeah.
Abdelmanem Galila, I can coach. I think that most of DNS administrator at ISPs doesn't prefer to do validation because that they thought that it is difficult to administrate DNSSEC or administrate the DNS servers that contain DNS validation. So when they use this Turris, it will decrease the administration side from there.
Will not need to care any more, right? So, but you know, it's unrealistic to believe that the 100% of ISP customers will have a single router or the same version of router, right? So, I don't think that's realistic to expect. So, but yes, with Turris, the validation is closer to the end user. I think it would be ideal if the validation would be even closer, so to on the personal computers, mobile phones, and stuff like that. But with Turris, it's a little bit closer to the end user, so it's a little bit better.
Okay, Andre, I thank you. Oh, was there another one I missed? Yes, please. There's a mic there and at the table.
Kazunori Fujiwara from JPRS.
Get nice and close.
Kazunori Fujiwara from JPRS. I have a question. The title says DNS check validation is done at CPE. Is it okay?
Why it shouldn't be okay? This is consumer premise equipment device, right? Your home router, and the validation is performed there. So I believe that's okay.
Pardon?
So the title is validation at CPE, which is consumer premise equipment, right? Which is the router in your home. So I believe that that fits the title.
Who validate
the router in your home?
Okay. And which software do you use in CPE?
Do you mean for the DNS validation?
Yes.
Oh, so as I said, the older version they used Unbound, and all the Omnias, which is, you know, vast majority of those devices use not Resolver, the software we develop at CZNE.
In CPE, Unbound or not Resolver runs on CPE. True?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I realized during this presentation that someone from my ISP at home is sitting at the front table that does DNSSEC, Joe with Comcast, and I use a Taurus router at my home. So I have direct access if I ever have any problems. But I have to say, in about 3 years of using the Taurus at home and the DNSSEC validation by Comcast, I have not had one single problem. So it works very, very well. So wanted to point that out to folks. Thank you, Andre, for the presentation. I think we need to move on. So, Rick.
Yeah, let's combine the two topics for today, case rollover and Taurus. So Taurus now can, the rollover of the keys could be done through Taurus automatically, or should be an intervention with the administrator?
No, of course it's automated. So.
Thank you, Andre. Our next presenter for the morning session is Jake Zack from CA Zira. You're doing it. Oh, okay. Good for you. Thank you. It's Jacques Latour is doing it.
The clicker?
The clicker, yes.
All right. So Jake is sick. Got a nasty cold, so he left, and so I'll be doing this presentation on his behalf, and I have speaking notes and everything, so here we go. So the talk is about the next generation signer that Sira we implemented recently, so we'll talk about that today. All right, so a quick overview. Similar to what we had this morning, but we have 2.7 million domain, 2,400 are signed, 80% of the signed domain are the registrant or in this room, I believe. So not a lot happening there. So the couple of ICANN meetings ago, we presented our solution with high availability signer, bind, and AEP keeper. So we got rid of all that and put a new infrastructure using OpenDNSSEC and the Gemalto HSM. So we migrated, so we did a KSK rollover and migrated our entire infrastructure with a new signing solution. So that's the talk for today. So the setup that we built 5 years ago was very high availability infrastructure because we were mitigating the risk of having DNSSEC failure. So we back then we had two zones. We generate the zone twice. We'd sign it with different signers, OpenDNSSEC. We sign it with bind, and then we did extensive zone validation. So we compared one with the other and make sure there were no differences between the zone, and then we publish the zone live on the internet. So when we put this in production in the first year, we found a few bugs that could have been operational. So the value of that system worked back when we didn't really trust the signer. And the lessons learned is we've learned a lot from that architecture, and then we came up with a new system that is way more efficient. In terms of high availability, back then we use Oracle, hot standby. So the backup site was always a cold with up-to-date data, so we have to turn it on. So the process to go to the backup site was a little bit complicated. So we had active, passive Oracle database for the registry. We use OpenDNSSEC, the beta version, when it was installed, and that was the same version that we use in production. We never upgraded that version, so if it doesn't break, don't mess with it, so we didn't. And then we had a lot of issues internally with validation, the zone, the empty non-terminal issues and all that. So over the year, we built customization to make sure that our legacy setup worked. The process, it took about 35, 36 minutes to generate the zone. It was based on cron. So we generate the zone, sign it, do a bunch of validation, a lot of file copying, SCP of zone file to compare the one with bind, the one with OpenDNSSEC, and make sure it's all that. And we copied the zone at our backup site and signed them also at our backup site in real time and compared the whole thing. So it was very extensive data manipulation process, and we've optimized that with time. With the system, we never had a zone outage from our signer solution over time with all the redundancy. Back then, we didn't have any automatic failover from site to site. That's something we wanted. Everything was bare metal, so all the signer, all the validator, everything were blades, servers with OS, and a lot of copying and a lot of processing to do our zone. So that was way too much. So what we decided, the other thing is we were using the AEP keeper. They were running on a five-year limit. Everybody's saying they're going to start to die. So we looked at replacing that with much better load balancers, much better process. So the AEP keeper, you need to manually go on site and put in cards, and they were good at the time, but today there's way more modern HSM that can be more efficient and offer the same security. The validation part. So in the beginning, comparing both zones, we found a lot of bugs and issues and problematic implementation with .ca. Mostly that we have within .ca, we also sign third-level domain because we have provincial. So we have on.ca, qc.ca, all the provinces. And then we have delegation at the third level. And that caused issue with zone validation. So that often when somebody put in a DS record, we also have legacy for four level of zones. We have city, province. So when you add the DS at the four level, but ON and the city is not signed, so not a lot of validators support that type of infrastructure. So it took a while to fix those issues. The other thing is Bind and ODS, they sign differently. So Jake had to manually once in a while go in and clear the signer because we're comparing Bind and OpenDNSSEC. And once in a while he had to, on a manual do manual intervention to restart our signer. So that kind of, especially during a Super Bowl weekend, Jake didn't like that. So the new setup is much, much simpler. We went from 16 physical machine to 8 VM. We could have went to 4 VM to make it simpler, but we decided to have our the zoned distributor on their own instance in different. So all of these boxes are in different security zones, all firewalled internally. So it's much more streamlined architecture. So we have zone generation, signer, validator, all in one box, and then we have two for availability and two zone distribution. So it just works. We did a bunch of evaluation, and we decided to use the, I'm not sure what they are. It's Tel, they bought Gemalto, they bought Luna, they bought SafeNet. So it's one of those HSM, pick your company, people call them different names. We call them the Gemalto. And we like them because you can do pretty much everything you want with them. So you have partitions. The main reason we went from AEP Keeper to the Gemalto is that the signer solution we have is integrated in a new service we want to build, which is DNSSEC signing service. So we want to be able to use this infrastructure to suck in zones from .ca registrant eventually. So second level zone, and then sign in here and return the signed zone to a customer, and not having to replicate the entire infrastructure. So the Gemalto is one of the good infrastructure to support this. There's a lot of capacity, so you can have 20 partition and up to 5 years of keys pre-generated in each of the partitions, so they're very flexible to support. And the other thing is it was much easier with the Gemalto to do the key signing ceremony. With the AEP Keeper, it took forever. And with the Gemalto and the process they have, it's an hour instead of a few hours of key ceremony. So it's easier on the process. The other thing we did also is we switched from Oracle standard and we went to the Oracle ODA and DataGuard. So that's the Oracle appliance, and it's actually active. So that's pretty neat for the registry. That means we generate the DNSSEC signer. They generate active on both sides, and then we distribute our zone pretty much real-time from both the backup and the primary site. The note here is our backup site is less than 1 second behind the production site. So this, it works great. A little bit expensive, but it works. So we don't do assign the zone anymore. We just we picked ODS. That was a decision. So we don't have any issues with empty non-terminal anymore. So we use Spring Batch and orchestration and all that. So the zone generation works much better now and assigning. The HSM are low balance. Before, we had an HSM dedicated to a server. Now they're just a pool of HSM available for signing. We use the same HSM security control framework than we built for the initial key signing ceremony. And here's a word you haven't heard in a long time, or DPS. Defines the structure for managing the keys. So we have different... Do we have special slides? Yeah. So we have different people in the office with different roles that can do different things on the HSM, and Gemalto to support that in the same way that the AEP Keeper Avid. So we have Crypto Officer, we have Witness, we have Admin, and certain people have access to rooms and other not. And so with the AEP Keeper, we were able to replicate and maintain the same DPS, our DNSSEC practice statement that we had in the past. So all of that works with the Gemalto, so that was a good thing. We didn't have to reinvent our key signing ceremony process. It's much easier with the little thumb drive to do the ceremony. They have a keypad and a thumb drive that you can use to manage your crypto ceremony, so it that was more efficient. So at the same time that we did the HSM key rollover, we had to do a KSK rollover because we had a new KSK in the HSM. We had the old KSK in the AEP keeper, had the old one. The new key was in the new HSM. So we took it slow to do the KSK rollover and to do the HSM rollover. So at the same time, we migrated the entire process. So it's pretty hard to see here, but we have the KSK that was in production. We introduced a new KSK in the zone with the new signer. And over time, we migrated. So we had one key, we had both key, we had the new key signed with the old key, and then we did the switchover of the HSM, and then the old key was signed with the new key, and so on, and all the INA changes were done. So pretty much straightforward key signing, key rollover process. So at one point in time, we talked about doing a protocol change, and we might have went, based on what we learned at the NSO work, that would have been a bad thing, I believe. So that was enough just to do the KSK and the migration. So we took it slow. We waited, I don't know if we, weeks between every step. There was no rush to do this. Our KS, so we had multiple KSK, multiple ZSK, so it got bigger at one point in time. But the entire process actually worked well. We didn't have any outages. So we cut over, went smooth. Nobody noticed or emailed us or saw any issue. The cool thing is that we used to generate the zone file before on an hourly basis. Now we're down to 30 minutes. It actually takes 11 minutes to do it, so we could even go faster, but we want to wait a little bit to do that. KSK process with the new the KSK ceremony. Now that we can remotely manage the HSM is minutes of process instead of manually having to go on site and play with smart cards in HSM. So that history is gone. So Pearl, poor Pearl is gone, no more. So that's it for the process. There's no notes here, so. Questions?
Thanks, Jack. Do we have questions for? Go ahead, Robert.
Hi, this is Robert Martinezian from PCH. I think it was... si querés, hablo en castellano. If you want, I speak in English. And Spanish, sorry. Never mind. You mentioned something about that the old HSMs and the new HSMs were very different in terms of management. It sounded like that was... you got a lot of benefits just from switching, and you didn't need extra hardware for backup and stuff. Is that just because you switched, or is that like just an optimization did at the same time? Because you had that thing twofold. That one, you have Gemalto backup unit, same security level, and before you needed an offline full HSM. You don't need an HSM now?
So before we add the offline HSM, so we do the key signing ceremony in our office with the offline HSM that was in the safe. We generate the new keys on that, and then you smart card out of that. And then you grab the smart card and you go in all the other HSM and you reprogram them. So with the Gemalto, they have a framework where you can have some sort of a keypad that you can use to remotely manage all the HSM. So you can push keys, change keys securely from a central location. And it's all, so you need to set up, I think it's a black key that creates a trust amongst all the HSM. And then from our office, we can actually reconfigure all the HSM using that keypad. So we need, instead of protecting, so the offline HSM was in a safe, only our lawyer could access. Now we have the keypad in the safe that's protected.
Okay. PCH uses the HSMs that you used to have, and we don't travel around the world to load keys. We I don't know why you need to do that.
So, you're offline. All your HSM are offline, right?
Our KSK HSMs are offline, yes.
Yeah. So our KSK is live here. So if we want to do anything, add a new customer, do whatever, we can do it right there and then. We don't need to wait for a key signing ceremony that you do on a quarterly basis to add and delete customers. No pun intended.
Right. No. There are pros and cons against on both sides, right? Okay. Do you have a video of your key ceremonies or something? Is that something you publish?
It's not published, but if you really want to see it.
I really want to see it.
It's going to cost a beer.
Go ahead, Joe.
Joe Abley. So I was just going to make a comment, and maybe you could. I remember the early days of when you first deployed DNSSEC, and a lot of the processes were modeled on what happened in the root zone, including the model of HSMs. And I think it was true at one point that was the only kind of HSM that was certified to the level that the U.S. Department of Commerce required ICANN to use. So there wasn't a lot of choice at that time, but it's good that things have moved on. But it sounds like what you've done is evolved the process from what was appropriate to the root zone with its heavy focus on physical security to something that's more appropriate to your operations. So that, I think, is a good message, because lots of people copied ICANN when designing their procedures around this stuff. So I think that evolution is good to hear about.
Victor?
Okay, Vincent Vigneron from AFNIC. I have a small question about the process. First question is more qualification. You say that with the new process, it takes about 11 minutes. Do you still do a complete zone file generation?
Yes.
And did you consider to use something more dynamic?
Yes.
And why didn't you do that?
Well, for .ca, it takes 11 minutes to do the full zone. So if we're able to keep the process we have within 15 minutes, it's good. But we only have like 2,000 signed delegation.
Yes.
So once we're in the million, then we'll revise.
That was my second question, was if you had to do the same process with, for instance, 10% or 20% of signed delegation, does it scare?
Eventually, we'll need, if we get adoption in .ca for DNSSEC, then we'll have a dynamic solution.
And last question, sorry, I try to be as fast as possible. Did you do some tests with, for instance, larger ZSK Because I know the signing process is longer with 2048, for instance, and did you test that, and does it scale?
I don't think that we did, but the performance level between the Gemalto 2 and the AEP is a factor of 10, more than 10 times faster, so that's we haven't done...
Okay, no, I say that because I know there is a factor of between Gemalto 2 and AEP, but with... different size of keys, sometimes the difference is not that bigger, so
yeah.
You should do some test about that.
We didn't play with that yet.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jacques. And our next presenter is Joe Crow from Comcast, who's going to tell us about negative trust anchors. Thanks. You're up, Joe.
Russ, a pretty small comment, actually. We are comparing different stuff because, as far as I know, the CAPER is still the only level 4 validated HSM in the market. The Gemalto is a level 3.
And we have no requirement for certification, so...
Completely, no. That's not the comment.
Oh, yeah, no.
Just commenting Joe's comment regarding the...
Yes.
Afternoon. Joe Crow from Comcast, senior engineer. We do DNS, NTP, and DHCP. We're a core network services team. At Comcast, we do about 500 billion queries a day. We've been doing DNSSEC validation since 2012. DNSSEC does scale, as I mentioned earlier. If you're out there, enable DNSSEC validation. It's pretty easy. But what does that mean for Comcast? Well, when DNSSEC validation fails, we get the blame. Customers believe we're blocking websites. You know, when a big company like us does DNSSEC validation, customers quickly reach out when they can't reach their favorite site. I know NASA.gov is usually the one place that everybody, or one instance everybody usually talks about. The one here is HBO Now. As soon as they went live with HBO Now, their DNSSEC validation broke. Their DNSSEC was broken. We couldn't validate correctly, and Twitter blew up. We net neutrality, we're breaking you. We're blocking you. So most of the fixes are people would switch to a non-validating resolver. Usually they try to switch to Google, but guess what? Google would be doing the same thing since they are doing DNSSEC validation as well. One of the temporary fixes that we can do is put in a negative trust anchor. So why would you use a negative trust anchor? Well, if you're too big to fail, then you know there's that instance of a security issue. Okay, do we know if this domain, NASA.gov, state.gov, sorry, it's a lot of .gov sometimes, is it actually a security issue or is it actually an operational issue? Well, most of the time, our experience has shown that it is an operational issue. Very rarely do we actually notice a security issue. And actually, the time that I've been at Comcast doing this, I don't think I've really ever seen a security issue. It's all been operational issues. So what do we have to do at that point? You know, a few options is just let the domain continue to fail. Turn off DNSSEC validation. Well, hell no, we're not doing that. Or we just put in a negative trust anchor for that one certain domain and allow that to continue to resolve on our resolvers with the known fact that it is failing DNSSEC validation in the back end. So implementing a negative trust anchor, when you first want to start doing negative trust anchors, you want to come up with a good process. You want to get together with your team, find out when and why you want to do an NTA. You want to also know how you can implement it on all of your resolvers. Internally, we use multiple vendors, so we want to make sure that we have a process and know the process manually for all of those vendors, because if your automation is failing for any reason, you still want to be able to implement this. And then stay consistent with that process. If there's something that had changed with how your vendor is implementing NTAs, make sure that you know that and you have updated everything correctly within your automation and your team knows what you're supposed to be doing. So, you know, we want to know what the risks are of keeping that domain to fail. Is there going to be costs associated with that? Is it going to be a long time that domain has failed? The more calls that we get in Comcast, the more it will cost us. So is it really failing? We want to know. Is it failing because of an operational issue? Well, at that time, we'll do our checks, our troubleshooting, and make sure that we reach out to the right people. We'll either do it by email, by Twitter, letting people know that we have seen a domain fail and that we're going to let it fail, and we've reached out to the correct people. We do have an @ComcastDNS Twitter handle, which it is actively used and monitored by our team. And then automate, you know, you want to make sure that if you're touching more than, 25 servers, more than two in reality, that you're automating everything. The negative trust anchor in this instance has to be approved in our org from senior leadership. If we can prove to our senior leadership that, yes, it is failing because of an operational issue, we've reached out to the correct people, but it has taken more than 15 to 20 minutes or 30 minutes to actually get a response back. If it's a big site like NASA.gov, State.gov, HBO Now, things like that, we would actually implement an NTA because the cost associated with that would be better than actually letting it fail. But we've gone through the correct steps. And again, that would be a senior leadership call at that point. Automation helps us scale. In our case, we run multiple vendors with different commands to implement our NTAs. And if there's an error, in one spot, and it's broken across the board. So it's broken the same way. We know that it's broken the same way, and we can fix it pretty easily at that point. Just like any good operations team, you should actually be doing your testing in a lab. Everybody says, oh, I do all my testing in production. So that's not the best place to do it. So our basic automation at Comcast, we utilize SaltStack for our automation tools. With that, we have pillar data that allows us to just update one spot with the domain that we know is failing. That allows us to put the pillar data to be consumed by more than one vendor and one script. And then we have one command that's run from a SALT master that can push to our hundreds and hundreds of servers. We would usually do it in a rolling push. That way we can test in one area, make sure everything pushed correctly, and then just roll out completely everywhere. It'll usually take anywhere between a couple minutes to 10 minutes, depending on how fast we really want to get it out, if we want to roll it and test it, or if we've tested it enough and we know that it'll push correctly with no errors. Our basic structure is for our pillar data, as you can see on the right here, is it's a YAML format. We have an internal NTA and a customer NTA. Our internal NTA is actually going to be a lot bigger. A lot of old bad practices internally can break DNSSEC. There's improper delegations, dotted host records in places there shouldn't be. When we're trying to implement DNSSEC internally, that's been one of our biggest hurdles. So when we apply the NTA state to all of our resolvers, and then, the above YAML format and that data will be consumed by scripts, consumed by another file, and then we do our testing after that. Most everybody here should know basic troubleshooting, DNSSEC failure. you know, you will result in a serve fail, you know, appending a CD, you know, can you dig it? You want to make sure you can dig. If you can't dig it, that's the first step. And then, you know, testing with other DNSSEC validating resolvers ensures that it's not just your resolvers. DNSViz is your friend. We actually own dnssec-failed.org, which purposely has broken DNSSEC. So if you wanted to turn on DNSSEC validation on your resolvers, you can actually use that as a testing domain to ensure that DNSSEC is validating, or in this case, not validating correctly. In case of a key rollover issue for some sites, we would just do a cache flush across our board, and that usually would fix DNSSEC failures at that time. One thing that came out of the conversation from OARC is how we could share NTAs, you know, from a big perspective like Google, Comcast, other DNSSEC validators. One thing that internally we've talked about is actually automating your own zones and using DNSViz's CLI, and you can actually load in your own zones and do, you know, checks with a cron job and say, you know, are my zones working correctly with DNSSEC? And if they fail, you know, emails you, alerts you any way that you want, and at that time you can find that issue before it actually gets out to the wild. TTLs sometimes are your friends in this case. Yesterday, state.gov was failing for a little bit, and after a while, they fixed their stuff, and we were still holding on to old data, and it was a simple cache flush for us to actually fix that. And that's it for my talk today. If there's any questions.
Questions for Joe? Yes, Paul, find a mic. And you can say who you are.
Paul Wouters. As the John Gilmer wisely said, if you can't not trust your friends, who can you not trust? So in this case, we wouldn't know if you place a negative trust anchor in there for malicious purposes or because, let's say, the imaginary government puts a gun to your head and say, you must do this because, you know, we demand it. So do you in some way publish negative trust anchors that you have inserted? And of course, how do you then avoid having sort of a wall of shame, which, you know, also nobody really wants? But it would be nice if there's some way of auditing what you're doing.
Currently, we do not have anything that publishes the NTAs we have put in, and I agree with you, the wall of shame sometimes is not the best way to, you know, call people out and saying your stuff's broken. But unfortunately, at a scale of Comcast, we kind of have to let our customers know that we're aware of an issue. And that's where our at Comcast DNS Twitter handle comes in handy, because we can pretty much say we are aware that this website is failing DNSSEC validation. We're giving them a chance to fix it and then go from there. As far as trying to publish the NTA records, I was actually thinking about this the past couple of days. That would have to be at a community at large type of thing, where we all get together and say this is how we would like to publish something like that. I don't think a company like Comcast should be the one that dictates that type of thing.
Other questions for Joe? Robert, go ahead.
What if DNSSEC is enabled on twitter.com and it fails?
You're SOL. yeah, don't know. At that point, you know, we would try to find another way. Our frontline support would know that DNSSEC is failing for bigger domains. Smaller domains, unfortunately, we're not really worried about the smaller domains. We're worried about business partners and people that websites that can really just cause that that uproar from people.
I have one last question, I hope. Viktor Duchovny, I know that your mail team has a similar process for whitelisting Dane domains that are failing. Do these go through the same kind of logistics, or are they completely separate?
That's completely separate. The mail team has their own process of whitelisting. That's a different process than what we currently do.
So we have some folks coming in for a meeting that starts at 12:15, but we have so is there a scheduling faux pas here? Oh, my. Well, okay. So our lunch isn't going to be ready until later. Meeting room conflict. So I guess there's a scheduling error.
Yeah, it's like everywhere it shows them right now.
Okay. Okay, so we had a change that the workshop program committee didn't know about. And so we will have to go ahead and clear the room. And our lunch is scheduled for about 12:15 or 12:20. So we can wander up there slowly and do the quiz after we come back, if there's still time.
The tickets are
these. So be sure you have your ticket when you head up. The lunch is on the terrace on the third floor. So please, everyone, go ahead and pick up your hardware, your lunch tickets, and take your other papers if you don't mind. So it'll be a clean room for the folks that have it during lunch. 1:30 is our start time.
Okay. I have a request. People be on time. I have a lot of slides, so I don't want to start late.
And also, can someone check that we actually do have the meeting room at 1:30?
Yes, back here at 1:30.